The idea that an ancient civilization once thrived where we now walk is so enticing and magical. And at an archaeological site in Kansas, it also happens to be true. The lost city of Etzenoa, an indigenous settlement long suspected to have existed, was found by a researcher at Wichita State University about a year ago, and limited tours for the public are just now getting started. But access to the site is tricky. There's a modern city on top of the ancient one, and a lot of the things you'd want to see are on the water. But what's there matters a lot to members of the Wichita tribe, because the people who lived in that ancient city are their ancestors. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're kicking off today's Central Standard with Donald Blakesley, the Wichita State University archaeologist who located the site of this ancient settlement. Hi, Donald.
Good morning.
Now, you're going to take issue, I know, with my calling this a lost city.
Yeah, that's right. It's a huge site, but it has not many of the features we expect to find in a city.
But okay, it is a former settlement where indigenous people once had commerce and infrastructure, right?
Yes, but not the kind of infrastructure we expect in a city. Our cities are centers of government, of education, of religion, of commerce. This place was probably held all or most of the people of a subdivision of the larger society that the Spaniards knew as Quivira.
Okay, we're going to get back to that, but I mean, this is a place that people long suspected to have existed, but they couldn't find it. And so Lost City, just to me, captures the excitement of that. I mean, is there another phrase that you think would be more accurate that still captures how really cool this is?
Well, archaeologists in recent years have come up with the term megasite. There are other places around the world that have huge populations but don't appear to have been on a trajectory to create the kind of cities we're used to.
I like megasites, I'll admit that. But anyway, tell me about what you've learned in the time that's passed since you found what remains of Etzenoa.
Well, currently we've been working on the structure of the site. Eyewitnesses in 1601 described it as consisting of clusters of houses, 30 to 40 houses in each cluster, separated by agricultural fields. What we're finding are two things. On the surface of the ground where it's plowed, we find concentrations of stone flakes and other items that may represent those clusters of houses. Using high-tech equipment such as magnetometers and ground-penetrating radar, we can see clusters of features that are either those clusters of houses or places where what archaeologists would call activity areas, work areas where people created a lot of pits and fireplaces and so on when they were doing work.
What work were they doing? Do we know?
Well, they were their main activity, it seems, is processing bison products. They made a whole series of highly specialized tools to process both bison hides and bison meat.
Do I understand that it's like commercial quantities of bison, or so it appears?
That's my argument. I have been recently working on the stone tools, trying to figure out exactly what was going on. And about 80% of the tools they made out of chipped stone appear to be specifically for bison processing.
So, I mean, does this change how we think about the way Native people in this country lived before Europeans arrived?
For this area of the world, it definitely does. Everybody has thought of the plains as relatively thinly populated, but we are working on one of minimum eight, maybe a dozen sites of this scale within the area that was called Quivira. So rather than having a few thousand Wichita ancestors, it in somewhere 160 to 250,000 is more likely.
The other thing that I kind of wonder, I mean, I'm far from an expert in this, but the way people talk about Native people in this country and their history, it's as a nomadic history and a settlement with commercial quantities of bison being processed really is a very different picture in my mind.
Absolutely. People make all sorts of assumptions that turn out not to be true. So Native Americans began to domesticate crops several thousand years BC. And we can see that they, things like modern day sunflowers, that's was domesticated in the United States. There were other crops that went out of use. So they did that when they got to productive enough. People settled down in over most of the eastern United States. So they were sedentary and their populations got large and they had contacts with people at huge distances. One of the accounts I read recently, when Spain took over Louisiana from France, in Texas, they had to explain to the natives that we're here now and the French are gone. And the local folks weren't believing them until one of them stepped forward and said, oh, yeah, this happened. I was there. He was at the fall of Montreal, and he was from Texas, and he was a native. So they moved around. They were in contact with one another. They exchanged information. There was a continent-wide network of people.
Yeah, so I'm curious what it is about the site and what you've seen there that really, like, captures your imagination as far as understanding the reality of how people lived on this continent before Europeans arrived and maybe shortly after, but like in a way that does kind of change things for you personally, even.
Oh, it definitely did. Back in 2006, we published a book on Kansas archaeology, and I was the co-author of the chapter on this archaeological complex. And if you read that, I'm talking about clusters of villages, and there's not a mention of a large town, much less multiple instances of those large towns.
So tell me more about, what is it, megasite?
Yeah, megasite. It's a category that didn't fit into everyone's expectations of, oh, initially people would live in camps because they were nomadic, and then they would form little hamlets which grew into villages, which grew into towns, and eventually develop cities, growing in size with each step, sort of an evolutionary sequence. But these sites, they don't share a whole lot of characteristics, but they are huge, and they show up in places that no one expected previously.
You know, the people who lived in Etzenoa are considered the descendants of the Wichita tribe, and we'd hoped to have the tribal president with us today. We don't, but you have worked with the communities near the site, people who are there today. What does this mean to them, to the best of your knowledge?
Well, first of all, the Wichitas have been involved from the very beginning. As soon as I figured out what we had, I invited some of them up and gave them a tour, not only of this site, but others as well. And they have been making visits every year, bringing their high school students with them, among others. So we're in constant contact with them and have their full support.
Has anyone expressed feeling really like strongly personally about what they have learned about their own ancestors?
Yes, I've seen some of that. In fact, the tribal president practically broke into tears talking about how important this was for educating their children and showing them that there's a lot that they could do, because their ancestors had done fantastic stuff.
I do understand that there is limited access to the site for a lot of reasons, including that this city or what's left of it is underneath a functioning modern day city, a solid built environment bustling with activity.
It's partly under real city, partly under residential neighborhood, and partly under farms. And that does make it hard. There are hundreds of people who own pieces of that land, and we have to work with all of them.
So, I mean, is this a larger ethical conundrum for the anthropology community in general? Because I'm hearing, you know, like there are people, farmers, for example, who own land there, but that this is a place with really significant meaning also to a tribe in the area. What do you do about that?
Well, it's you have to tread carefully. By law, if a farmer retains the mineral rights, everything under the ground belongs to that person. And so if we want to excavate and we want to put the resulting artifacts in a museum, we have to get their permission. And we don't at the same time want to offend the Wichitas today either. So you just have to work carefully. Luckily, the people of Arkansas City, where the site is, understand that there's the potential for economic development in the long run. And so the city officials have been strongly behind us. We have had cooperation from the local community college, from practically everybody.
What about what people can see already? Because tours are beginning, and I understand they're on the water.
Well, there's a talk about having stuff on the water. That really hasn't happened yet.
Oh.
Again, it's modern law. Most of the site is along the Walnut River, and the Walnut River was never designated as a navigable stream. And so if you want to do a float trip down the Walnut, you need the permission of the landowners whose land abuts the stream. So that's a difficulty.
What can you see from the water?
Well, you can certainly see where the site was. What the tours are doing, they're going to the local museum and watching a video that was produced a couple of years ago that's excellent quality. Then they go to usually to the spot where the Spaniards first saw the people from the town. Well, we have access to that area. And then they go to where there was a battle that was fought in 1601 and get to see that. There's a ravine there that the native people took shelter in, and that's highly visible. Then they tend to go north, and it depends on, first of all, on the landowners. But one of the places you can see the most of the site is at the local country club, which has a nice parking lot, so they can pull in there and look around and see a couple of trash mounds and things like that. So and we hope soon to have some land to the north of that we will have control of and can build some walking trails and so on.
Well, Donald Blakeslee, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Donald is an anthropologist at Wichita State University. In just a minute, we'll hear about the only land dinosaur to have lived in Kansas. What? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're going from ancient civilizations to dinosaurs in Kansas. I love it. Our next guest is going to tell us about the Silvosaurus, a dinosaur that's made a triumphant return to the Natural History Museum at KU with a skeleton, I think, more complete than ever. We'll hear about that and also a stunning new interactive display right along with it. David Burnham, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
So is it fair to call the Silvosaurus the Kansas dinosaur?
Yes, I think so. It was found in Kansas and probably lived in Kansas as well.
Probably lived in Kansas. Go on.
Oh, well, back 100 million years ago, There was shoreline right in the area of Salina, and it ran north-south. So there was this beach that was forested, and we think that's where Silvosaurus lived.
But there were other dinosaurs in Kansas. They just lived in the water. Is that right?
No, technically no dinosaurs lived in the water. Oh. Mosasaurs may live in the water, but they're not dinosaurs. But there were other dinosaurs that may have lived along with Silvosaurus, but the only evidence we have is for this skeleton, which was found in that beach area. And we also found footprints or trackways that we think may belong to this dinosaur.
So tell me what you do know for sure about the Silvosaurus and what you surmise about the Silvosaurus, how it lived, what it liked to eat, stuff like that. Do we know?
Yes, we do. We found a really good skull, and it has a lower jaw and an upper jaw with teeth. So we can look at the teeth and surmise that it was a plant eater. There have been other dinosaurs found in Canada, Montana, that are related to Silvosaurus and are so well preserved, their bodies are intact, and we actually find some with stomach content. So we know they belong to a group of dinosaurs called Ornithischians, and Silvosaurus in particular was a plant eater, and it probably fed on the plants in that forest.
Did, you know, the original discovery of the bones on display, what's the story behind that?
Oh, that's a really interesting story. So there was a rancher, Warren Condre, and the species is named after him, the Silvosaurus condrei. And he was a rancher that lived north of Salina near Minneapolis. And on his land, he had a set of rocks we call the Dakota Formation. And he noticed bones weathering out of the rocks by this stream. And he became concerned. He must have realized they were important. And he actually called a state senator, who then called the provost at KU, who then called the vertebrate paleontology department and sent the person that, you know, whose job I have now out there to go collect the thing. And so it was gathered up and brought back to the museum and initially prepared and described by former curator named Eaton.
Have you had any contact with the people who made this discovery?
Oh, yes, yes. Over the years, the son has come visited, the grandson, who actually teaches school in that area, have always been interested in KU and come, and we chat sometimes, and we actually loaned them some specimens to put in their little museum. Kind of some of the story is firsthand information. He provided me with, you know, he remembers when his dad found the specimen and, you know, he was kind of like peeking, afraid to trample on any bones or anything. But they realized it was a significant discovery and brought it to our attention.
How big is this thing?
Oh, it's probably not even 10 feet long. The head's maybe 12 inches long, and with the head and the body, 12 feet at the max. We got everything preserved from the tip of the nose all the way to the back of the hips and the first couple tail bones, so I don't know exactly how much longer it would be. But it's really interesting because it's covered with armor.
What?
Yeah, so they have these bony plates embedded in its skin that kind of cover the dorsal or the upper side of the body and around the sides. And not only do they have these big blocky scutes, we call them, but they also have scales in between them.
I'm still having trouble picturing this. Scutes?
Like an alligator.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that's
not
dermal
that I
armor.
See alligators on a regular basis, but I know what they can, are.
Yeah, because they got their thick skin and they have bony plates. And so this guy had the same thing. And more interesting, some of these modified into spikes. So they had a series of parallel spikes going down its neck, and the largest spikes were right over the shoulder. And we did find one of the spikes and parts of the armor. So it's, you know, it's a pretty bizarre-looking dinosaur.
And so this dinosaur, was what remains of it, was on display previously and now has come back on display. And I understand that it's more a more complete model, I guess?
Yeah, initially the exhibit showed a few bones from Silvosaurus and then a couple of bones from another dinosaur called Claosaurus, which was a duck-billed dinosaur. And they weren't even the same age geologically or from the same place. So when they decided to revamp the exhibit, they asked me, well, how much of the Silvosaurus do we really have? And I said, well, quite a bit. Let's go look. I took them into the collections. They got pretty excited when they realized, oh, wow, you know, you got backbones, you got ribs, you got spikes and armor.
Why weren't they all part of it from the beginning? I don't get it.
You know, that was before my time, but the biggest problem was that the rock was considered too hard to clean a lot of the bones out of it. But when they brought it to me, we have new technology that we're able to carve this rock much more easily than, you know, the former workers that did the job.
That's cool. I love that new technology is saving prehistoric fossil remains. There's something kind of beautiful about that.
Yeah, it is. And people think, oh, paleontology, they're still doing everything the same old way, plaster field jackets, da-da-da-da. But, you know, actually we do incorporate as much technology as we can into our work now.
Do you feel like any affection for this Silvosaurus? I mean, I'm just curious, as someone who works closely with the bones of creatures that once walked where we now are, but that you haven't gotten to interact with in their, like, living form, do you feel like you have a relationship with that creature nonetheless?
I've always been curious about that one. And then just a few bones that were out there, I would go back in the collection and examine the rest of the specimen and realize they had a cast of the skull on exhibit instead of the real skull. So I went to the exhibit people and I said, hey, you know, can we put the real skull in here? And they, oh, yeah, we'd love to do that. So that kind of started it. But then when they decided to redo the exhibit is when we were able to actually introduce the entire skeleton. And I had former students and colleagues that have been interested in this thing. And so it's kind of like over the years, we learned more and more about it. We were able to assemble the rocks where the bones were. And some of the bones are preserved as bones, not, you know, hard parts. You know, you can see, you know, the end of a leg bone, the skull. However, the rest of it were impressions of the bones that were left in the rock. And so this thing was exposed, it weathered out, some of the bones were lost, but they left the details in the rock, and so we were able to copy those details when we did our restoration.
What does that feel like to you, to see it in its more complete form?
I love it. I mean, I live for restoring past life.
Oh, what does this past life tell you or tell us? I mean, if you think about how people's imaginations conjure Kansas and its history, what does this piece of information that this skeleton carries add to that?
Oh, this is quite a significant discovery because it's one of the more primitive members of the group. And so we know the origins of this type of dinosaur are very close to what Silvosaurus looked like. And it's such a bizarre animal. And with all the armor and spikes and everything, you have to realize that for sure they had predators out there, and I'd like to find one of those predators.
Give them peace of your mind?
Yeah, how old are you picking on Silvosaurus? I think they would have had a hard time getting at the belly. So I think these, you know, Silvosaurus could just squat down and just, you know, tighten up, and it's just a ball of armor. So,
I mean, yeah, it's nice to have armor if you have a predator.
Yeah, and the head. All the bones in the skull are all fused together and thickened, so that's not even really attackable.
You know, you mentioned that you think this creature ate leaves or plants of some kind.
Yes, and based on what we know about the teeth and other dinosaurs of this type, but also that Dakota Formation had been famous for preserving leaves, beautiful preservation, and whole leaves to like maple trees and such that you can even see the veins in the leaves and then the little veins coming off the main vein. And so it's highly detailed preservation for the plants.
It's when I think about Kansas identity and the role of like beef in that, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? And then I think that about the fact that it sounds like the only known dinosaur that we're pretty sure lived here was a vegetarian.
That's right.
Our roots are vegetarian.
Mm-hmm. And we also had beachfront property.
I mean, what else about this new display will help people see all of this part of our past differently? Because it's a pretty elaborate new display beyond
It is. It is. And we're very lucky to have a new paleontologist on staff who is also an artist. And he recreated the life of Silvasaurus, and you can see completely fleshed out, and in the background you can see the trees, and then you can see the beach and the water, and it's just a beautiful painting. And it's his job was based on science. He took a cast of the skull and built it from that, and so it was based on direct measurements, and also the leaves were based on fossils.
Paleontologist David Burnham with us from KU's Biodiversity Institute and Natural History Museum. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
In just a minute, our history lesson gets a lot more recent with students' rights going back to the 1960s. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now the story of youth activism in the United States. Students' rights to express their views at school. That story is personal for a Kansas Cityan who was a plaintiff in the Supreme Court case that established whether students have any such rights at all, Tinker versus Des Moines. And it all started with armbands protesting the Vietnam War. Mary Beth Tinker, who was wearing those armbands to school in Des Moines, is with us now. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me on today. I'm not actually a Kansas Cityan, but I am a Missourian. I spent many years there living and working at various hospitals and clinics as a nurse with children and youth. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining me. Take me back to the incident, the armband incident that drew you into this larger story in a way you probably never imagined.
Well, in 1965, the Vietnam War was building up, and in 1964 was the Gulf of Tonkin incident. There was so much going on in those mighty times that are so much like today, actually. The civil rights movement was, really building, and then the Gulf of Tonkin. And so by 1965, there had been about 1,000 U.S. soldiers killed in Vietnam. And we would watch it on the news. I was growing up in Des Moines, Iowa, where my father was a Methodist minister. And our family later became involved with the Quakers. And so they're all about peace. And we would watch these scenes of war on the news and hear Walter Cronkite talk about the body count every day and see the children running from their burning huts, and we were very emotionally moved by that.
So you wore armbands, and there were students all over the country wearing them, right? It was kind of a coordinated effort.
It actually wasn't that coordinated. Students did off and on wear them in those years, and after that also, but ours was more of a local action, and it really started from the students at the high school, and they had been talking with actually some college students and also adults. There was a group called Iowans for Peace, and the first national rally for peace in Vietnam was held that November of 1965. And so the high school kids in Des Moines heard about the idea of wearing black armbands, and they decided to do that Christmas to mourn for the dead on both sides of the war and to support a Christmas truce that was being called for by Senator Robert Kennedy that year. And so I heard about it. I was only in eighth grade. I was 13 years old, and I heard the plan. My brother John was in on the plan, and some others.
How old was he?
My brother was 15. And so a couple of days before I was very nervous and scared. I certainly wasn't a person to go out in the front of anything particularly. I was very shy. But I heard about it, and I was so emotionally moved by what was going on in the news. A lot like the students today who are moved by gun violence. We were also emotional about gun violence. In our case, it was about war. But our emotions pushed us to take action.
Yeah. Do you remember, I mean, just as far as going back into your emotions at the time, what our country's involvement in Vietnam meant to you and your brother as young people specifically that might really not have been the same as how grown-ups experienced it?
Yes, it's very much a story, and it became a Supreme Court case about the rights of young people to have a say, to have input over the issues that affect their lives. Because the boys, they were going to have to sign up for the military at age 18 and then possibly be drafted. But they were being told that they could not wear a little piece of black cloth on their arm to express their feelings about the war. And so it became a children's rights issue, a teenager's rights issue, and that's really the context that I see it in today.
Well, looking back just at what happened, did you guys kind of did get in trouble for this, right?
Yes, a couple of days before we were going to wear the armbands that Christmas, December of 1965, the principals heard about the plan and they passed a rule against armbands. And
specifically against armbands, like a no armbands rule?
Yes, it was a rule against black armbands, and it came out in the Des Moines Register. It's really a story of the free press also in journalism. It came out in the Des Moines Register that the schools would have a rule against black armbands and that students would be asked to remove their black armbands. Now, one of the ways that we actually won the case was because it was viewpoint discrimination, because the schools had allowed black armbands in the schools. One situation that they allowed them in was to mourn the death of school spirit. And they had also...
You could mourn an abstract concept, but not people.
Exactly. And unfortunately, that's the case too often with students' speech rights. If you're speaking about something that's minor or that's, something that really doesn't affect the national picture or national policy or even local policy that really affects your life, it's okay to have a say. But when students start speaking up about the issues that really do affect their lives in major ways, that's when some adults, want to censor.
Well, so it's interesting, though, that the form of speech you were planning to exercise was silent, armbands. That's a particular kind of speech, right?
Yes, it's called symbolic speech, actually, and the schools had also been allowing other kinds of symbolic speech. They had been allowing, for example, the Christian cross on kids' necklaces, and they had been allowing pins and buttons, and even one button that was held up at the school board meeting that said, "Down with pants." So they just didn't want us to have our symbolic speech, I think because it was controversial, and the school board president, I think Ora Niffenegger, said later that in the paper he was quoted saying that the government has made a policy about Vietnam and we should support it. Well, that's not the way that democracy works. The citizens and the people do have a right to criticize even their government. We have a First Amendment, the right to free speech, free press, the right to assemble, the right to petition, and the right to our own religious beliefs.
So
we did have those rights, but it hadn't been established at that point in time.
I want to understand what unfolded here. I mean, the Des Moines Register comes out and says that there's going to be this rule against black armbands at school. Did you wear them anyway?
I kept going back and forth. I wasn't sure if I should do it because, as I said, I was very shy and I certainly didn't want to get in trouble. I was, things were going along pretty good in my life. I went to slumber parties and I had friends and I studied for my classes and got good grades and things. And I didn't really want to jeopardize all of that. But I had very strong emotions about the building war and the scenes that I saw in the news. That combined with examples that I had in my life of people standing up for what they believed in, what they believed was right. Some of those people were children. For example, in Birmingham in 1963, the kids there had the Birmingham Children's Crusade, and almost 2,000 kids marched and sang and got arrested and got attacked by dogs and water hoses. And we had seen all of that on the news as well. So we had these examples.
And you had admired those children for doing that?
Yes, we did. We thought that they were so brave and so courageous to stand up against segregation and against racial discrimination. And my parents were also examples to us, and they also stood up against racial discrimination. Really, our actions in some ways were based on the civil rights movement, because in many ways they had been our inspiration.
So tell me about the legal battle around this. How did it start? Was there a conversation at the dinner table where someone said, you know, we might have a legal case here, we should fight this no armbands rule?
My dad didn't really want us to wear the armbands at first, because he said the schools, they have to run the schools, and the principals, it's not so easy for them. They have to make their rules. But we knew something about our dad. We knew that he had kind of a strong belief in using your conscience. And so we talked to him and told him that it was our conscience. And even my little sister Hope, who was in fifth grade, my brother Paul was in second grade, they even wore armbands to their elementary schools because we talked to our dad and told him that we were just speaking up for our conscience, which he had done also. But 5 kids were suspended from the Des Moines schools, a district of 18,000 at that time in 1965. And so there was contact then with the ACLU, and I'm not sure exactly how that happened. I think a couple of the students had contacted them before we even wore the armbands, because they were worried after the rule came out against the armbands. Bruce Clark, Ross Peterson, Chris Singer, a few of the high school kids there at Roosevelt High School. And so the ACLU got involved, the American Civil Liberties Union. They go to the Supreme Court more than any organization in the United States because of their, stand for the First Amendment and their rights, and other parts of the Bill of Rights, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, and the 19th Amendment. But the ACLU got involved, and they said, first, you have to try to negotiate with the school board and try to change the rule. And that's what I always encourage students to do. Try to negotiate first. And so we did that. But they wouldn't change their mind, and so the ACLU initiated a court challenge, and it went to the district court, and then to the appeals court in St. Louis, to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, where we lost at both of those, and then it was appealed to the Supreme Court.
What was it that the U.S. Supreme Court saw differently than the lower courts in overturning those previous decisions and ruling in your favor?
The United States Supreme Court, well, it really matters who's on the court. And you had people on it that really believed in the rights of young people and in the First Amendment and free speech. People like Thurgood Marshall, who had been the lawyer in the Brown decision in 1954, speaking of the rights of young people. And then Abe Fortas, William Brennan, and others who really were strong on the First Amendment.
So it was how the court was composed, really.
Part of it was the composition of the courts, although I have had a chance to speak with Justice Alito in the last few years, who's on the court right now. He's very conservative. And I asked him, you know, would you stand by the Tinker ruling? Because I heard them ask that in his Senate confirmation questioning. They mentioned Tinker. And so he told me again a few years ago, yes, I would stand by the Tinker ruling.
Well, in the ruling, like the language around that was that students don't shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. And the U.S. Supreme Court has a podcast that I've just discovered called Landmark Cases. It's got legal experts talking about the significance of certain cases, including yours. Here's what they say about Tinker versus Des Moines and why it matters.
It made very clear that we need to take the civil liberties of students seriously while they're in the schoolhouse. Teaching young people how to exercise their rights of citizenship and allowing them to do it is at the heart of our democracy. So if you cut off speech while people are learning both their own personalities and identities and also how to behave in the world, you minimize the likelihood that they'll be active participants in democracy. So when you ask how it impacts our lives today, Tinker has been used to protect student speech that schools have improperly cut off. And that's why it's so important for average citizens children and their families to know the law and to use the law and to be prepared to stand up for it.
Mary Beth Tinker, you actually go around the country now teaching students what their rights are.
Yes, I do. I'm actually a nurse, and I've spent many years working with children and teenagers in hospitals and clinics. But I now have switched over to a new kind of health that I'm promoting in young people. It's their civic health. It's encouraging them to know about the Constitution and the basics of our democracy, and to use those ideas and those foundations to advocate for their own interests. And that's really what democracy is. And I think that it's wonderful when young people use their rights and use their foundations that they've learned in school or elsewhere to stand up and speak up for themselves. You have a great bill right now in Missouri that is on the verge of passing, and it's got about a week left in the legislature. It's called the Cronkite New Voices Act. It's a bill for student journalists' rights, and something like it has passed in 14 states, and now Missouri has a chance to be the 15th one, and it would protect the rights of student journalists, and students can find out more about that or others at newvoicesus.com.
Well, I want to jump in.
It's about Walter Cronkite. Speaking of Walter Cronkite.
Well, yeah, I do want to jump in and say that bill partially inspired a show we did on student journalism today a while back, if you want to look that up. But
yes.
We're going to talk to Margaret and Lee Summit about her story. But if you out there have a question about, you know, what students' rights are, we're joined by someone who's experienced protesting the Vietnam War in school and fighting a legal battle that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, determined those rights. Call 816-235-2888. We've got Margaret with us now. Hi, Margaret.
Good morning.
What do you want to share?
Well, I am a product of the Vietnam War as well and didn't know that we could do this. My daughter, when she was a senior at Lee Summit North, came to me one afternoon and asked if I had any solid black fabric to make armbands in protest of our involvement in Iraq. We made about 100, and she took them to school the next day and watched them become little pieces of black fabric as students were ripping them to share the message of protest and wanting us to withdraw from Iraq. And she got called into the assistant principal's office. She was going to be suspended for 10 days for causing a disturbance. And the principal happened to walk by and asked what was going on. My daughter was an honor student and very active in school activities and couldn't believe it.
Not often in the principal's office.
Right. Not often in the principal's office. Exactly. So the principal asked her what was going on. And Elizabeth said, well, we're being suspended for causing a disturbance. And so he read the suspension papers and he ripped them up. He said, you cannot deny her right to free speech. And so this was 2003, 2004-ish. I can't remember exactly. But I think it's very interesting. Didn't know anything about a law and Supreme Court action. I just knew that I needed to support my daughter in her right to speak her mind.
Well, thank you for that call, Margaret. You know, Mary Beth, this does bring up that, you know, in this case, there was someone in this very high up in the school administration, the principal, who knew that the school has its own code of discipline, but that there's also that the Constitution still applies to students when they're on school property. But I'm guessing that not every administrator knows what students' rights are, and not every parent or student knows that that's the case.
No, and thank you for sharing that story, Margaret. I speak often with school administrators and school attorneys, and you know, we really need to encourage young people to know their rights and use their rights, because that's how we keep these things alive. And I always encourage administrators also. I speak at a lot of colleges where people are learning to be administrators in graduate programs in education at universities. And I encourage administrators also to don't just think of the law also, because think of what will promote young people to be engaged and to be involved in civics. I was just at a big statewide program in Kansas, sponsored by the Department of Education for civic engagement of youth. And kids were there speaking up about all of the things that they're speaking up about, whether it's animal rights or racism or the environment and so many other things. We want to encourage civic engagement among youth. And by clamping down on them, punishing them, it doesn't encourage them, it discourages them. So that's why I say to administrators, and there are so many who do encourage youth to speak up and use their rights in ways, of course, that are respectful. And when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of students in Tinker versus Des Moines in 1969 by 7-2, the court also said that neither students or teachers leave their rights at the schoolhouse gate, and that schools should not be enclaves of totalitarianism. Now, sometimes students have something to teach their teachers, but they said that students are limited in what their how their speech is used in school, and that students cannot substantially disrupt school and cannot impinge on the rights of others.
Let's bring in Warren in Kansas City on this. Hi, Warren.
Warren, Mary Beth, congratulations.
Hello, thank you, thank you.
Our family were friends with the Tinkers in Des Moines. We were with Mary Beth and all of those people. I first want to say she's not really being honest about the incredible courage and commitment it took to do that. The harassment was unbelievable.
Tell us more about that, Warren.
The name calling. It's not much different than what went on with racism in the South and the civil rights movement in Des Moines. It was amazing the stuff that was always happening in the anti-war movement and the commitment, pure simple commitment, that Mary Beth and John and the rest of them took on in the school district. And the school district was vicious in its attacks on them. Vicious, nothing short of vicious. But they stood their ground and they won. And lastly, you know, Margaret Mead once said, and I can't quote it exactly, you know, that it really only takes a few people to change what goes on this planet. And this is a case where that's the truth. When you look at it, it just takes a few people to make a difference forever for all of us.
Warren, I think something that you're getting at that I want to ask you about, because we're talking about activism at school, and it sounds like, I don't know whether you were or were not one of the activists yourself, but that even being a student among people taking a stand had a profound impact on you.
Yeah, I'm quite a bit older than she is. So I was being an activist at Drake and in anti-war movements, even after I moved to Kansas City. But yeah, it's all about making a difference and exercising your rights and, you know, making yourself known. And that's what makes democracy and America great.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Warren.
Thanks, Warren.
That's so true. And I'm so glad that you said that, because we do have a chance to speak up and make democracy great. And people in Missouri have a chance. One of the worst Supreme Court cases for students' rights also came from Missouri. It was Hazelwood versus Kuhlmeier. And now with the legislation that has been passed unanimously by an education committee there in the Senate, you have a chance to override that decision, the Hazelwood decision, which allows student newspapers to be censored. And so with the Cronkite New Voices Act, people have a chance to take a stand and call your state senators this week and encourage them to vote for that.
What is different about student activism today when you look back at your own experience? We see the parallels, but what is different?
Student activism today, I think, well, we had armbands to express ourselves. Students today have the world in their pocket with their phones, and they can get online and they can use social media to connect, and they can really amplify their voices in so many ways. And their allies are standing with them to say that, yes, when students don't have a say and don't use their voices, we're all cheated. And so that's what I want to do, is to be an ally with young people who are using their voices to make a better world.
Mary Beth Tinker of Tinker versus Des Moines, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's a wrap. You can listen to any of this morning's conversations here on KCUR Central Standard at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have them ready for you later today. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. You can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST and I'm at Gina KCUR. Tomorrow, the food critics will join us on a search for great noodles. And also, we're going to talk about Missouri trout and how local chefs are using it on their menus. This show is produced by a bunch of people, but today I just want to give a big shout out to Matthew Long Middleton. He will be producing Central Standard for a few more days. But today is his last day running the show from his perch in the producer's booth. He's been my lifeline from the beginning. In fact, he predates me on this show, so thank you, Matthew, for showing me the ropes. And don't worry, Matthew will keep contributing to the show from his new role. I'm Gina Kaufman, over and out.